to take you back to the finding of the trackway in the trench. Were you actually there when it was discovered?
I'm not prepared to say.
Okay. And you talked about how Peter Skidmore had examined the insect life from around the trackway.
Hmm.
Can you tell me why he did that? Why that was? I'm going to talk to Peter, but can you tell me why he would do that and why that would be important?
Yeah. Okay.
Ron.
Right. With regards to the trackway, you've got to bear in mind that at that time, we were not well, to say the least of it, we were not welcome on the moor. And a variety of people would come on with William Bunting. We went on under the protection of a piece of historic legislation that Bunting had discovered. So it was under the heading of... people who had rights on the moor and rights of access to the moor were the commoners of Thorne, their heirs and assigns, and in that William Bunting was a commoner. You can't get any much commoner than William Bunting. He was a commoner of Thorne, and we were his assigns. So we went under this. We were on there under his jurisdiction, shall we say? But. I shouldn't really say frog march. No, I wasn't frog march, but I was on with a bunch of people, including William's, one of his sons, Bill, young Bill, who was, he'd been very ill. I think he suffered from asthma very badly, but I think there'd been all sorts of other medical problems, and he'd been... what you might call a sickly child. He slowly became fit enough to come onto the moor. He was a very, very determined young man, quite fabulous actually. I think his mother and father were really probably without him realizing, but very impressed by his grit and determination. He was bedridden for ages. He didn't go to school for ages, and he's decided to try and build up his strength by the local authority had just started. They just built swimming baths in Thorne, and he decided to teach himself to swim and to swim a mile. I mean, this is somebody who, you know, is too feeble to go to school. And he built himself up, and he ultimately did swim a mile. But he would come onto the moors with us when this dam building business was going ahead. And on one occasion, young Bill was not very well, so I agreed to sort of take him off the moor and take him home. And we were grabbed by the police. I mean, it's just so ironic. Now the local authority has a Thorne Moors access officer. Then you were taken to court. If you were done at law for actually setting foot onto the place. Now how things change, and this is all through William Bunting. I mean, if it hadn't been for Bunting, there'd be no, you know, conservation argument to argue over. You know, it would be just purely academic.
Were you arrested?
Hmm.
On what grounds?
Well, because we were trespassing on... I think there had been fires on the moor, and I assume that some of Fison's equipment had been destroyed and damaged. Destroyed or damaged. But, that's another story. I remember being on top of Thorne Colliery Tip on one occasion, looking out over the moor when it was burning away. The fire brigade was on there, and there was clearly somebody out there setting fire to parts of the moor while the fire brigade were on. you know, I mean, it wasn't ours. I mean, we didn't want it to burn because of what we knew was on there. And there were certain, curiously enough, a great friend of ours, Helen Kirk, brought a photograph of a spider into the museum the other day, for a spider for identification. And it was it was a thing called Aranius marmoreus var, variation of variety, shall we say, pyramidatus, var pyramidatus. And when I used to go onto the moors in the early 70s, this was quite a feature, quite a flamboyant species, quite a colourful and big species with huge and powerful webs. I mean, you could literally get caught up in these spiders' webs. Amazing things. I'd never seen anything like it before. Well, after these, there was a series of fires. Well, I hadn't seen any of these, this particular kind of spider, from the early 70s until Helen Kirk brought a photograph of one in just the other day. So fortunately, these things are still around.
A photograph of one that had been seen on fire?
Well, this particular one, no, it had been seen on Potrick Carr, again, which is, in a sense, similar to Thorn Moors, similar to the edge of Thorn Moors. The edge of Thorn Moors is, you go through a series of sort of fenland habitats until you get out onto the mire itself. Well, Potrick Carr is a fen, calcareous fen. So these spiders are sort of bog and fen indicator species.
Let's go back.
Go on.
Let's go back to Peter's work. I will be speaking to him.
The tramway. Yeah, we'll ask him about the tramway because it really is quite fascinating, and it was a splendid breakthrough, and so much of subsequent research programmes on the moor have sort of hinged on that early work that he and Paul did. There was somebody, what were they called? Kenwood. Can't think of his Christian name now. Anyway, Harry Kenwood. The celebrated Harry Kenwood. This trackway had been found. In order to work out what the habitats were like, what the climate was like, what domestic fauna was present, if any, peat samples were taken from around the balks of wood down there. And in examining these samples of peat, the chitinous remains of insects were revealed.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the insects have an external... We have a bone skeleton inside our flesh. Well, insects are constructed with an outer skeleton, an outer armour plating. And that that skeleton isn't made out of... calcareous bone. It's made out of a material, of an almost indestructible material called chitin. So they were looking for insect remains, chunks of chitin effectively, and they found it, and they found lots of fragments, and they found lots of fragments of clearly lots of different kinds of insects. So they weren't looking at an insect, they were looking at a whole fauna of insects. And in looking at, in putting together these species lists, it became possible because of what we know about current insects, it became possible for Peter and Paul and Harry Kenwood to look at these species and to say, look at the sort of climatic regime that must have prevailed to enable these things to occur. Only you get this where species have a northerly distribution, or Mediterranean distribution, or a Central European distribution. So they were looking for indicator species which might give a clue as to the prevailing sort of climatic conditions. Where human activity came in they were looking for species that were associated with domestic animals, you know, pigs, sheep, cattle, etc. And sure enough, they found species associated with cattle, cattle dropping, cattle dung. So your trackway was possibly a droveway. You know, gradually, by using these very imaginative and at that time seldom used techniques and technologies, this picture started to emerge as to what was going on down there, and what was going on more, you know, more significantly, what was going on in the landscape, in the Thorn landscape, at the time of the forming of the moor.
A whole
series of subsequent studies refining certain elements of that have gone on. Largely, that occasion in many ways changed Paul Buckland's academic life. He was here as a field archaeologist. He had associations with the York Archaeological Trust, and he ultimately went to Sheffield University as a lecturer and ultimately professor of the department there. And in his role at Sheffield and now in Bournemouth, well, hang on, just a minute, he went to Birmingham first, wasn't it? Yeah, he went to Birmingham and then Sheffield. And both in Birmingham and Sheffield, he sort of left a trail of students who were looking at this paleoarchaeology or paleoentomology research, which said so much about, I mean, climate change is very, you know, very much at the front of politics and press these days. Well, they were looking at that. They were sort of getting a fix on what was happening in the Bronze Age by looking not particularly at botanical indicators. Now, this had been done in the past, but it was found that the insect remains were a far more refined means of monitoring what temperature regimes and weather systems were prevailing at that time. But, you know, there's been a glamorous series of students from that time, from the 70s to the present time, of students who have produced absolutely excellent and most inspiring work, really come, you know, on the back of Bunting's interest, Pete Skidmore's interest, Paul Buckland's interest, which you know, it has refined and further refined what is known about these faunas, climates, and so forth. The one very interesting piece of work, relatively recently done, was looking at the dendrochronology, or the aging, the tree ring aging of oak, but particularly pine, on Thorn Moors. Fisons having milled large areas of Thorn Moors down as more or less as far as they physically could do, got down to either the underlying clay or a very thin skim, a relatively thin skim of the peat. And in certain light, I mean, this time of year, well, autumn, winter, early spring, where you get these very powerful low sunrises and sunsets, you can look across the peat surface, and any slight undulation is highlighted. I mean, it's an ideal time of year for looking at ridge and furrow in the countryside at large. But on Thorn Moors, you could see where Bronze Age trees had been. The stumps and root systems are still there, and you can actually work out the distribution and the population densities by looking at by using this technique.
You mean tree population density?
Yeah. One of Paul's students took samples of many of these trees. She was able to age them, relate the ages of those trees with subsequent generations of trees from other sites, and right up to modern time, to actually backtrack back to actually how she could, you know, she was able to age those trees, and she was looking at the advance and decline of tree populations as the moor was developing and sort of almost moving about in a sort of amoeboid sort of way as it was growing as a raised mire and expanding or indeed contracting. But yeah, I mean, these things were just unheard of and totally undreamt of and unexpected when William Bunting was first drawing us into this work. I mean, had he not shouted long and loud and generally sort of embarrassed people into taking an interest in the site, it certainly, well, my view is that it would have been destroyed beyond any sort of salvation. Its after use as a sort of brownfield site would have been, for some sort of industrial development. It certainly wouldn't have been a site of special scientific importance, National Nature Reserve, and now, of course, these various accolades of international importance that it enjoys. At one stage, the National Conservation Body, the Nature Conservancy Council, felt that thorn moors was so important, people ought to be kept off. Then they took the view that it had been so despoiled by the peat industry that it wasn't really worthy of conservation status. And sort of William Bunting more or less single-handedly cajoled the Nature Conservancy Council into they had to sort of come kicking and screaming into the realisation that in fact it was important and ultimately very important and ultimately of international importance. So, you know, we owe an awful lot to William Bunting. At the same time, he was fighting not just that battle, but many other battles in terms of public access to river banks, canal banks, where traditionally individuals and local authorities had prevented people gaining access to paths, trackways, green lanes, etc. He spent endless time researching the basic archival proof that these means of access to the countryside, you know, were there, were legal and should be exercised instead of should be suppressed. His routine was to force this kind of documentation out of private hands or out from suppressed circumstances into the public domain, and he would try to create multiples of copies and place them in archives, local authority records departments, etc., etc. He had a very close relationship with York University, particularly through their then librarian Harry Fairhurst. I think he'd known Harry Fairhurst for many, many years, and indeed a number of the lecturers and departmental heads at York. He'd helped them in their academic pursuits, you know, decades earlier. So they they understood what his campaign was about, and they, you know, they took him very seriously, and you know, where they could, they helped him. And certainly the majority of his archival of Bunting's archival evidence that he used in a whole series of public inquiries and court cases, that ended up at in the York University archive.
When you described how this is, when you first came to this museum, it was extremely active and academically and intellectually very active in the naturalist field.
Mm.
And we've now reached a point where it has, the Thornmoors itself has stimulated a great expanse in knowledge in all kinds of fields. Was there any interest and activity on Thornmoor in the naturalist field before William Bunting sort of enabled access and encouraged people, well, in fact forced people to come on to have a look at it?
Oh yes, there was there's long been an interest in the natural sciences on Thornmoors. When you are able to speak to Martin Limbert, one of Martin's preoccupations has been to pull together historical studies which show individuals, the work of individuals on Thornmoors going back centuries, to be honest. The local historians and archaeologists have known, for instance, the writings of Abraham de la Prime. And it was really only William Bunting who took that kind of evidence seriously and tried to match that kind of not contemporary. So I think even when de la Prime was writing, it was sort of, even then it was retrospective, but matching his diary writings with trying to sort of pull together hard evidence to support what de la Prime was writing about, and more particularly to actually find documentary evidence in long suppressed by vested interest, but evidence of documentary sources sort of buried in the National Record Office, Public Record Office, thank you, yes. Again, he made contacts down there with certain individuals who understood what he was getting at. Not your sort of Jobsworth type characters, but people who realised that these documents were live documents, centuries old though they may be, you know, dating back to the, in this particular case, the first half of the 1600s. And he found versions of documents where he was able to track back to the original and then find subsequent editions which were fraudulent in the interests of, I suppose generally you would say landowning interests, I suppose. It was all heady times. One of the people who, it'd be very nice if you could interview him, Jerry Perlman, who was for a time he was Bunting's solicitor or legal advisor. Bunting was entirely self-taught in the legal arts, shall we say. Probably it would be right and proper for other people to explain to you why that was, but in terms of presenting his case in the courts and preparing casework and so forth, he used Jerry Perlman Jerry Perlman was based in a legal practice in Leeds. He became the the legal advisor for the Ramblers Association. And I should imagine, to a large degree, a fair amount of his background knowledge and experience and use of these obscure archives was as a result of his close contact with William Bunting. I remember being in Jerry Perlman's office on one occasion and seeing in the waiting room and in some of the rooms photocopies of legal documents that Bunting had spent years trying to track down and finally acquired. As he knew from his various researches that these documents had existed and probably still did exist, and he managed to track them down, and these were photocopies of them were adorning, framed photocopies were adorning Jerry Perlman's suite of offices in Leeds. Very frightening times in many ways, because we realised that I think most of us were from a background of where to be in the newspapers was a terrible disgrace. I mean, this was shameful, really, and to be cited in a court case was decidedly not done. And it was quite terrifying, because you were completely out of your depth, and to be called as a witness was quite frightening, which did happen from time to time.
Are you prepared to say in what sense?
Well, this was to do with access to Thornmoor's. This was round about the time of Bunting's Beavers, so-called, where water was flooding off the moor and indeed been pumped away from the moor by the local internal drainage boards. So Bunting's idea was to dam these up when the workforce, Fison's workforce, came on Monday morning. They would dig them out. Next weekend, the dams would be put back bigger and broader and deeper than ever before. They'd then be dug out or dynamited out. They'd be put back in. Trees and shrubs and railway sleepers and all sorts were bunged in. With it being peat, you could put gelignite in and it would explode out, but it would all sort of slump. It'd be like sort of blowing a hole in custard, it just sort of flowed back in. So ultimately, Fison took legal action against Bunting, and I think, the storyline goes the writ was delivered to Bunting's door, and knock, hey, William Bunting, here's a writ, opens it up, and to the amazement of the deliverer of said writ, shouts through to his wife, who referred to as mother, hey mother, what is it, William? Fison's are taking me to court. Oh, William, that is good news. And of course they just couldn't understand, but Bunting had no monetary resources, so he couldn't take a major industry to court. But if they took him to court, he could then bring all of his archival background supportive evidence and the justification for as you probably appreciate from other people you've been interviewing, Bunting took the view that a private industry was making money for itself and its shareholders, which and that funding, that money, that wealth should effectively have been going to the commoners of Thorn, because the access to the peat for fuel or whatever use was for the benefit of the commoners of Thorn, their heirs and assigns. So that was really his campaign.
So he had his day in court.
He had many days in court, and of course, as you would appreciate, if you win, then who you've won against will then appeal, and it was just sort of a ricocheting sequence of in court appeals, counter appeals, etc. And his health was deteriorating very rapidly, and ultimately he simply couldn't defend his case.
And this case hinged on his argument that it was an argument about access, that he had a right to go on to the area that Fison's claimed they had the rights over.
That's right, yeah. Well, not he, but all of the people of Thorn, the commoners of Thorn.
It was
a document called the Decree and Award. If you speak to Peter Skidmore, he will talk to you in detail about that. But that was the document that it was all hinged on.
And you've already talked a little bit about how that affected you personally in when you visited the moor and you were marched off and by a policeman. When you look at the other people, yourself and the other sort of interested and academic people working on the moor at that time, making these significant discoveries, did it affect you on a practical basis, or did they tend to leave you alone because they knew you were doing some significant work? Were you doing it with Fison's knowledge and tacit approval? Is really perhaps a way to put it also.
What we were doing here was to collect, and I think this would be the case with most people from the universities. They would go on. I mean, it wasn't destructive or anything like that. It was you would go on and record and collect and write up an analysis of your findings. And it was really that Pete Skidmore and myself and others were involved with. So in journals like, I mean, there's a wonderful organisation called the Yorkshire Naturalists Union. It's a union of anything between 40 and 60, it oscillates between 40 and 60 natural history societies in the Yorkshire area. It also has many individual members, but the great strength of the Yorkshire Naturalists Union is that it's been going for an awful long time. It started off in the 1860s. It's been running a standard series of field meetings since the 1870s. It still goes on in the same sort of way, so you can monitor change because the methodology is much the same. And it's been publishing for that period of time, essentially through a journal called The Naturalist. Fantastic journal it is. Initially it was a monthly journal, then through the privations of two world wars it dropped down to being a quarterly journal, which it is at the moment. It's currently edited by Professor Mark Seawood at Bradford University, and it's a fantastic journal. It deals with a broad range of subjects, largely but not exclusively related to Yorkshire and the north of England. But the YNU, Yorkshire Naturalists Union, produced a bulletin which comes out twice a year. The YNU publications had a great sort of hunger for new information. Many of the discoveries on Thorn Moors and ultimately on Hatfield Moors were published in The Naturalist. And this is, you know, broadly what Pete Skidmore and myself were doing and many others. Martin Limbert, who hopefully you'll be interviewing in due course, was very actively collating, very disparate information on all sorts of groups of organisms, mainly birds, but all sorts of other organisms, and collating these into rather important papers that were, for the first time, easy of access. You didn't have to do, months and years of slavish archival work. There it was for all to see.
And were obstacles put in your way of you collecting this practical information, or did you find it easy? And
I think all the obstacles were fended off by William Bunting. I mean, we effectively had a free ride, as it were. He cleared the way, and we sort of went on with him or through him. It wasn't just Thorn Moors either. The initial, what we were racing to pull together initially was a document, what turned out to be a very corpulent document, and ultimately a very influential document in terms of later work, on Thorn Moors, but the Hatfield Chase generally. And this first document was called An Outline Study of the I can't think of what it was called. I was going to say An Outline Study of Hatfield Chase, but I think let me just reach one down. I'll be with you in a sec. Get step ladder out and reaches to the top of a rickety pile of documents.
Study of the Hatfield Chase, the central electricity generating board proposed to Fowle. That was the lauded title of the first document. But effectively, it brought together from huge literature searches by William Bunting, Malcolm Dalby, who I've mentioned, who was the keeper of archaeology here, myself, and Peter Skidmore. And that was to form the basis of a proof of evidence that William Bunting was able to use to fend off the use of Thorn Moors as a fuel ash disposal site. Very shortly after that, in those days there were just two nature reserves in Doncaster. One was Sandal Beat Nature Reserve. Its legal status was local nature reserve. And then there was Potterick Carr, or Low Ellers as it was then known, Low Ellers Nature Reserve, which was a Yorkshire Wildlife Trust, or Yorkshire Naturalist Trust as it was then called, nature reserve. The Low Ellers Nature Reserve had a most inspirational chairman, who I mentioned earlier, whose name escapes me. This is so embarrassing. Roger Mitchell. Roger. Prior to the building of the current M18, the Government Transport Agency
were seeking to put a motorway round the southern side of Doncaster, and there were three proposed routes. The favoured of the three took out Sandlebeat Wood and Low Ellis Nature Reserve. So again, Bunting to the rescue, we've got to fight this right. I want you all to just dig around and get as much information about these sites as you can. So again, a huge amount of literature searching. I mean, you've got to bear in mind, it was before the days of computer databases. You literally had to do literature searches. You got to read everything. I mean, there may well have been indexes, but that hardly helped. You just got to go through the lot. One of the great strengths of Doncaster Museum is that we had good runs of relevant scientific journals, particularly The Naturalist, which I've mentioned. So the Doncaster Naturalist Society, the Doncaster Ornithological Society, Yorkshire Wildlife Trust, of course, because it was their nature reserve, and in that Sandlebeat was a local authority property, although I think the local authority was sort of neutral on where the where the road actually went. They were in favour of it happening, but precisely where, I think they were happy to, you know, listen to argument. So we all had to give evidence at the Peter Skidmore, myself, John Barwick, who was the curator here, the director of the museum service, he had to give evidence too. But we produced one of the documents I've just shown you as the basis of all of the biological information known about these two sites. And again, they turned out to be far more significant than anybody had previously appreciated. The element, I think it was the whole document. The document itself was republished by the Yorkshire Naturalists Trust. It's quite a rare document, but it's the basis, really, of all biological recording, modern biological recording, on the very successful Potrick Carr Nature Reserve. I mean, that really has been a huge success story in terms of visitor centres and all the rest of it. And of course, it simply wouldn't be there if it hadn't been for all that effort. Shortly after that, some lads from Edlington Comprehensive, who had been campaigning for saving Edlington Wood, they'd been getting nowhere by making representations through what they thought were the normal formal channels, by, you know, talking to councillors and the local authority, who I think had been sympathetic, but not able to sort of rise and save the day on behalf of these lads. They, in desperation, went to William Bunting, and William Bunting thought, yeah, these kids are thinking for the future generations. They're wanting to save that wood for the local community and whoever comes after them. You know, it's not a sort of self-serving project. You know, they're looking at community interests. Right, and people like that, Bunting would help. He was absolutely worn out most of the time, because he'd work round the clock. And, you know, although he was, you know, fighting battles on thorn moors, public inquiries here, there and everywhere, people from all over the place were coming to him with their problems. There was, for instance, open cast coal mining proposed for Temple Newsom in Leeds, or one or two places in West Yorkshire. And the local people, in desperation, came to Bunting for help. What should we do? How should we fight this? How should we approach the situation? You know, what's the best use of our and everybody's time? So not infrequently, the same gang of people who helped him on Thorn Moors were helping him at Temple Newsome on the outskirts of Leeds and various places near Castleford and so forth. And it's amazing. It's left, we stumbled across a bit of scruffy woodland, but because of the species that were found in there, we found it wasn't just a piece of scruffy woodland. This was ancient woodland. The current generation of trees were not necessarily very noble and very ancient, but the site itself was. You had ancient woodland indicator beetles and spiders and so forth, and this was threaded into an argument put into the public inquiry. And although open cast coal extraction did go ahead, that wood and one or two other bits and pieces of ancient landscape survived. So, in all sorts of completely unsung ways, Bunting has left a huge legacy around the Yorkshire region those people involved will know and remember, but society at large won't.
We've talked almost exclusively, with the exception of what we've just been talking about Thorn Moor. Does Hatfield Moor figure in the scheme of things? And if so, how?
Well, an organisation called the Thorn and Hatfield Conservation Forum was established, based initially in Thorn at the council offices in Thorn.
When you say it was established, who came together to?
Well, in that it would have sort of worn most people, authorities, institutions out just to sort of continue running around after Thorn Moors. The local authority here who actually instigated this organisation.
With a view to what?
I would really have to. I was certainly involved in the early days. The participants were Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, what became English Nature, the Nature Conservancy Council became English Nature, the Yorkshire Wildlife Trust, and the. It was a sort of community project based in Thorn, and it was to pull together strings associated with Thorn Moors and bring it to the attention of the public at large. The work we'd been doing up till then, you simply didn't have time. Well, apart from giving talks to societies and organisations, there was no opportunity to speak generally to the public, to Joe Public, as it were. Although we did actually do displays here, and I did a travelling display that went to Doncaster Library. But generally, you couldn't. There was no full time. There's no full time sort of public outreach. Facility, so a project officer was employed to get the thing off the ground. One project that was highly influential was, and one thing that we've been crying out for ages and ages, was an entomological survey of Thorn and Hatfield Moors. And this was Again, this is something that you really need to speak to Martin Limbert and Pete Skidmore about, because they were more involved in a practical way than I was at that time. But it resulted in a project manager putting out on both moors, but mainly thorn moors, I've got to say, sets or grids of what are known as pitfall traps and water traps. A pitfall trap, you put, well, you dig a hole in the ground, a little hole in the ground, and put a plastic beaker in there. And then within that plastic beaker, you put another plastic beaker and put in there some water with some some suds to break the surface meniscus. So if anything dropped in, it would go straight in and drown. And a preservative, so the stuff that went in didn't rot. And you would have a grid, would be at four corners, a centre point, and the centre of each side. So 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and one in the middle, 9. So there would be 9 pitfall traps, and at each corner and in the middle was a little saucer on a stick, or a little beaker on a stick. So, and the idea was that any flying insects might be attracted to drop into that.
And how big would the grid be?
Well, it was a number of meters. It was quite, bigger than this room. And you had numerous of these grids across Thorn Moors and a few on Hatfield Moors. And it was a major military operation. And that was with the acceptance of Fison's. They were participants in this. That they'd been lambasted with claims as to how important it was from right, left and centre. So, they were wanting to see, whether this was true or false, I suppose. This trapping system produced tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of specimens. It was colossal. The lad who organised it at certain intervals of time gathered all this material out back, reset the traps. They collected specimens, were put in numbered tubes, which grid, which pitfall trap within each grid, etc. He then painstakingly, and I mean this is a gargantuan piece of work, he then rapidly went through each tube, and of course there were hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of these tubes, because he was gathering them in, was it every month? I can't remember, or every fortnight. But at every collecting there were hundreds of tubes, and he was he'd brought together a number of experts who were prepared to identify material for him, either for free or for a fee. And so the flies would go, or a certain groups of the flies would go to a certain expert, certain groups of insects would go to other experts, other groups of insects, beetles for instance, would go to another expert, Hymenoptera, bees and wasps, or certain elements of them would go to somebody else, spiders would go to somebody else. And so it was parsed out, and as a result of that, a massive gathering of invertebrate data was compiled. We realised that Hatfield Moors was only perfunctorily being studied, so the museum service itself, well, this is purely Peter Skidmore's work, we mirrored the Thorn work in terms of the methodology, and we had our own grids of traps on land that belonged to the Lyon family, not Fison's, but the Lyon family. And it was moor edge right through to the centre of the moor, and an area of the moor that we'd got an agreement, a conservation management agreement on, a Section 39 agreement on, that had never really been cleared for peat, so you'd got a pristine situation there. And so Peter, more or less single-handedly, was identifying tens of thousands of insects. Only those he could do, those he couldn't do, were put to one side. And of course, those he put to one side, he returned to some of them, but obviously, I mean, all your species new to science are still there, not looked at. But a number of these query species he has looked at, and these have turned out to be unique to the moors. His work has upset a lot of apple carts, has led to the redrafting of identification keys. It's been an extraordinary piece of work.
From work on Hatfield Moor.
This is work on Hatfield Moors, and he's just published a huge magnum opus on the invertebrate fauna of both Thorn and Hatfield. This has just come out in the last few days, published by the Thorn and Hatfield Moors Conservation Forum, and absolutely beautifully illustrated by Peter. But it's categorised species according to their national status, red data book status, or nationally notable status.
What do you mean by red data book status?
Well, there in the wildlife conservation world, it's important to know. Certain species are protected under the Wildlife and Countryside Act, and it's important that these rare and endangered species are indeed rare and are known to be can be proved to be rare and scarce. So, in evaluating, and it is an extraordinary piece of work that the entomological fraternity, but through the Joint Nature Conservancy, the JNCC, they've put together what's known as the Invertebrate Site Register, and the Invertebrate Site Register identifies sites of importance for entomology up and down the country, and this system seeks to quantify the importance of sites by awarding brownie points. So something that's only known in sort of five sites in Britain has a particular category. Species that are known in, say, 100 sites in Britain, and by Britain I'm meaning John O'Groats to Land's End, I'm not sure whether Ireland comes into. I presume it does, actually. But if you've only got, say, 10 sites within that huge known sites within that huge area, then a species is demonstrably very rare. And the people like Peter Skidmore would then look at those species and find out their way of life, their ecology, what the problems are, whether what they need to continue their lives. So it's possible to work out whether those species are under threat, or it may be that certain species are rare, because that's their they're ultra specialist. They're not necessarily on the decline. It's just that they're their requirements are very rarefied, as it were. But yeah, you have different categories of rarity and endangeredness based on this quantification of how many sites these organisms are known to occur in, and what their ecological requirements are within those sites. So it's an astonishingly complex piece of cooperative research by both professional biologists, and more particularly by amateur entomologists, amateur naturalists. I mean, broadly, the expertise out there is with the amateur, professionals are too busy on their professional ladders and ticking boxes and clearing out, you know, doing house, doing administrative housework to actually get down behind a microscope to, you know, do the nitty-gritty of work.
Can I just ask you, where does the Red Book, the name the Red Book?
The Red Data Book.
Red Data Book.
Well, this is a sort of a shorthand title for, I think it was probably the botanists who produced a Red Data Book of endangered plant species, flowering plant species, in Britain, and it just seemed the right thing to call it the Red Data Book. So you have Red Data Book shorthand, Red Data Book insects, RDB Red Data Book. RDB, different categories of RDBs.
And it refers to the register that you've just described, is it?
Well, it refers to a nationally agreed register. So in Peter's book, just here you are. In order to sort of quantify the importance of these two moors, it's possible to compare the numbers and types of Red Data Book species for each site. In with this project are species which are characteristic of certain habitat types. And by showing the proportions of a fauna which fall into these various categories, you can tell. Well, for instance, thorn moors, although there are very few trees in the sense of, you know, ancient oaks, etc., thorn moors, according to its fauna, has a very strong ancient forest fauna. And even though the forest is gone, many of the species are still there. And more particularly, many of the forest species are there in fossil form down in the peat. So one of Peter's pieces of work is to look at the demise of ancient woodland faunas in Britain by looking at the presence or absence of certain key species through the peat horizons up to the present time. It's absolutely astonishing the work he's been doing.
Beautiful illustrations also.
Aren't they? Yes. Well, this is where Oldham College of Art is coming through, you see. he never did paint like Lowry, who also went to Oldham College of Art.
Well, I think we've had a tremendous long time, actually. You must be tired now, so if you think it's a convenient place to stop, unless it's something that you think I've missed that I should have included.
Well, I'm sure with your other participants, I'm sure you'll be covering all aspects. I've probably missed out, you know, there was absolutely central points that refer to my personal involvement that